We now have a panel of three gentlemen. You guys can come up here. We have Alex Zhang. Alex is a partner with King and Mallison, where he specializes in intellectual property and technology law. He has substantial experience in doing patent prosecution, patent procurement, and strategy. I don't have the other bios.
I can take care of it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Hello, everybody. You are all the diehards, either waiting for the reception or you really love this topic. So either way, we'll take it. Apologies for the deep voice. I'm working on my DJ radio voice right now, but hopefully we'll get through it. I am very honored to be with this group. Very briefly, Eric Schulman. I was previously a legal director at Google. Well, I was at Google for 9+ years, and most recently as a legal director wearing many hats, including leading licensing and running the online ads portfolio. Then I was recruited to be the head of IP at Uber for a while and have recently joined Fish and Richardson. Fish did an amazing job for both Google and Uber over the 10 years that I worked with them, and so I figured it was a great place to join. Joining me you already heard a little bit about Alex, but I'll expand. But first, I'll speak about Peter on my direct left. Peter is a patent trial attorney as well as a number one ranked author. Presumably, he has some Amazon statistics that he can share with us on that.
If you
want. Okay. And has practiced IP law in Silicon Valley over 25 years. He's the senior IP partner in Sidley Austin's Palo Alto office and is the IP lead for the firm's Korea practice. So Peter's going to be sharing his Korean expertise with us, which is quite deep. He's widely recognized for his IP work. Finance Monthly Law Awards 2016 named him the IP Lawyer of the Year. Not too shabby. The Daily Journal named him as one of the top IP lawyers in California for 2016. That's not the Daily Show, that's the Daily Journal. Let's see, he got his BA in Classics and a BS in Industrial Engineering from Stanford, just down the street. Received his JD cum laude from Georgetown. He served as a law clerk for the Honorable Ernest Torres in Rhode Island, and he's the immediate past president and now on the board of directors for the International Association of Korean Lawyers. So we're thrilled to have Peter here. For Alex, specializes in intellectual property and technology laws. His services include strategy counseling for foreign and domestic companies seeking market entry and expansion into China. So he joined King & Wood in 2001. I was just asking about sort of, the premier law firms in China, and King & Wood is one of the two top ones there. Alex received his BS degree in electrical engineering from Hangzhou Institute of Electrical Engineering. My father just told me he recently visited there, so hats off there. An MS degree in computer science from Beijing Technology and Business University, and an LLM specializing in IP law from Santa Clara University, also one of our cherished local institutions. And he's also a visiting scholar at Stanford. So with these distinguished panel members, let's dive right in. And I just want to throw out in the beginning, we'd love to make this interactive, so please interrupt us with questions as we go along. I'd like to start, Peter, with you with Korea. I think you were going to talk a little bit about sort of some statistics on filings.
Sure.
And procedural amendments, and then some licensing strategies as well.
Okay, so do we click or who?
I think, let me see if there's a clicker right up here. Oh, it's right here. Ah. That's the power strip.
Ron took it.
Maybe he did.
Did Ron?
Did he leave?
Ron take it?
Ron, you here?
Oh, there we go. He can click it from back there, I guess.
All right. I love speaking last panel of the last day. That's awesome. So, everybody's here, though, and hope you're all awake. How many people have been to Korea? All right. So I won't give a lot of background on the, on that country. It's, of course, a very large economic trading partner in the world, really large companies. And I think any outside counsel and or in-house counsel thinking about Asia has to at least give some thought on what you're going to do with regard to Korea. So next, next slide. So I'm going to, I've kind of divided this into some presentation stuff on prosecution-related developments and then litigation-related developments. Just, maybe people have done this. How many people here mainly do prosecution? Okay, and then assume the rest do licensing or litigation. Okay, so Korea has amended their Patent Act. In 2015, there was a change in terms of divisional. So if you're in charge of portfolio development in Korea, the old law in Korea was that you had to file a divisional application only in response to an office action. And so what that ended up meaning was if a notice of allowance had been issued, you could not file the divisional. And so until you got your office action, you didn't know whether or not you needed to file a divisional or not. And so the net result was people who wanted to make sure they got something often had to file unnecessary divisional applications. And so what they did was they changed the law a year ago. And so now you have up until 30 days, basically, after a refusal or during any period of amendment. So in other words, you can now wait to see whether or not you got the claims that you wanted before filing your divisional. And so that applies to new divisionals for notices of allowance received on or after July of last year, 2015. And that hopefully, for those of you in charge of prosecution costs and overseas prosecution costs, will lower the number of unnecessary divisionals you end up having to file. Request for examination. The Korean old rule was that you had you file your application, you have to file the request for examination, you had 5 years. Again, they changed the law recently. It's now down to 3 years. That puts Korea in line with the same deadline as I think in China and Japan for a formal request for examination. And one of the goals of the Korean Patent Office, the KIPO, is to hopefully get things through the system quicker as a result. If you want a delay, you can file a petition to delay examination, but now the timeline is 3 years. Okay. I came across some statistics. The average Korean patent examiner examines about 230 applications per year, right? As compared to at least statistically, they said a US patent examiner hits about 80 substantively per year. I don't know who made those statistics. I should have pulled it up. But in any event, there's been some focus on quality improvement in Korea as a result. And so one of the things that they came up with in this recent amendment this year was ex officio reexamination, which is after the decision to grant, but before grant, the decision is published, people can submit requests to reconsider, essentially. And it's not a formal cancellation or invalidation action, but they submit. It's like submitting information to the examiner. And the examiner, on his or her own motion, can ex officio re-examine the decision to grant. So this is pre-issuance re-examination. And it can be, it's based on prior art. The period is open basically until the first payment of fees by the applicant. And so, if you're in charge of a portfolio, now you have to worry about people coming in and attacking your granted but not yet issued applications. And this is one way to do it.
Do you have a sense of how often this is happening?
This is new, so okay. This is brand new, and so it remains to be seen how often people are going to take advantage of it. Now, if you are one of those attorneys who has a client who wants to monitor what competitors are doing, this is another tool in the arsenal to go after a competitor's portfolio. It's essentially ex parte, as far as I can tell. It's so new. And so you just submit the information, and the examiner decides whether or not to do something with it. The other...
Peter, I might jump in on there.
Yep.
So just anecdotally, in my prior life, I saw a company sort of attacking our patents in Korea, and through more formal invalidation trials. And the result was, happily, because we were filing at such volume, sufficient volume, that, you know, about half of the patents would get invalidated and half of them would effectively become bulletproof. So this competitor, I think fairly unwittingly, helped us to bulletproof our portfolio. We ended up having quite a robust portfolio. So I think you want to think about that in applying this strategy. If you're doing that against a competitor's portfolio that's of a reasonable size, you could in fact just be helping them to pretest their portfolio.
That's right. And so similar to kind of US re-exam strategies, if somebody actually re-exams, ex parte re-exams one of your patents, you could use that and flip it around on them. Right. And so that could definitely happen. Again, one of the brand newer proceedings is what they call the cancellation proceeding. This was part of an amendment this year. The old law used to be anybody in the world could file an invalidation action before the Korean PTAB, the Intellectual Property Trial and Appeal Board. But that procedure had a lot of procedural internal complexities that apparently not a lot of people used within the board. And so now they've got what they call a cancellation proceeding. And same kind of thing. It's modeled after Japanese post-grant opposition, which came into effect in 2015. You can file the request for cancellation within 6 months of the grant of the patent. So this is what it's kind of a little bit later in time than the ex officio re-exam. Again, the stated purpose of this is to enhance patent quality and get more invalidation decisions in front of the IP tab earlier. Yeah.
Comparable applications? Are the applications mainly coming from Korea? Are they coming from abroad that they have this huge volume?
So yes, on lower number of examiners. They surely have more. I don't remember. They have more domestic applications than international. But the Korean Patent Office, I think, is involved in the patent superhighway, I think, and so they get a lot of stuff outsourced to them as well. That their examiners take responsibility for. And that, I think that plays a little bit of a role in this, but I think the main thing is just the sheer volume of filings by the big conglomerates there that are trying to protect their domestic market. Moving to litigation. You can tell, so this is from the Korea Supreme Court's website. You can see the statistics. There was a big jump or a rise in litigation up till 2008, and then an obvious downward trend. And it's kind of hard to see the numbers across the graphs. I've got the actual numbers here. So 2008, 1,500 or so cases filed. Last year, 888 filed, all right? And so a fairly steep drop. And for a country that has clearly moved to an innovation-based economy and is trying to, at least as a policy matter, encourage IP development. This is not a helpful trend. As part of the amendments and things that they've done to change the patent law, which I'll go into next, they've done things that I think structurally are intended to encourage better and more patent enforcement through the courts. Okay, so the first thing is Korea has something like 58 different district courts, federal district courts. One of the amendments this year is all patent cases now, they used to be able to be filed in any district court, any of the 58, now they're all centralized. So there's only five courts in the nation where you can file a patent case. That's Seoul, Daegu, Daejeon, Busan, and Gwangju. Seoul statistically probably got more than half of the patent cases historically anyway. Under the amendment passed this year, even if you were, say, a company based down in Busan, you can still file in Seoul in the first instance. In other words, Seoul has nationwide jurisdiction and venue over patent cases. Now, they can decide to transfer out if they want to, but as a matter of first instance, Seoul is now clearly the preferred venue in the system. This is supposed to, similar to in the US where there are courts that have patent pilot judges and trying to concentrate the number of patent cases to a certain number of judges, that's clearly what they're trying to do, is get build up expertise in a small number of courts and then hopefully build up a better reputation for enforcement. Has anybody been involved in a patent litigation in Korea? No, okay. Korea, kind of like Germany, it's a split system. So you do invalidation before KIPO, the Korean Patent Office, and you do infringement cases in the district court. And one of the, that led to some of the obvious tensions that you could imagine, what if there's an invalidation ruling after the infringement ruling and after injunctions issued and damages have been awarded. So one of the amendments that was part of the amendments this year is you can the patent infringement defendant can ask to stay the infringement lawsuit until after the invalidation proceeding is done. So in other words, they're trying to make the patent office the primary venue first in terms of timing, let them decide validity, and then if that passes, then the infringement case can go forward. This change takes effect for any lawsuit pending now and anything filed after March 1st, 2017. Another change structurally to bring more stuff into the courts is ownership disputes. The old rule in Korea was if you had a dispute over ownership of a patent, the way to fix that was you had to go to the patent office and the IP tab, the trial board, and seek to invalidate the patent for improper ownership at that point, and then file a new application in your own name for the invention. In other words, if you thought you were the owner, you had to not invalidate through the administrative process and then file your own application. Now, all you do is you file an action in district court for over ownership, and just like any kind of ownership of property, the district court can change title to the patents. And that takes effect for patents registered on or after March of next year. Okay. Litigation. So Korea is a kind of hybrid system. Historically, their court system, partially based on kind of a Japanese model, which is partially based on a German model, but also because of the last 50 years, the relationship between Korea and the U.S., there's also been more of an influence of the U.S. style litigation. And one of the issues in Korea, like in a lot of civil law countries, is discovery. It used to be, until this year, that if you were a defendant in a patent suit in Korea, you could refuse to disclose your information on infringement or damages on the basis that it was a trade secret. And you could simply refuse to produce it. And they had limited discovery anyway. And the old law allowed the judges to have the discretion to make negative inferences against you for your failure to produce. But as a practical matter, the judges in Korea never made those inferences against you. So as a practical matter, a plaintiff who was asserting a patent that, for example, was software-based or required some internal information on how the accused product worked, couldn't get it from the defendant. And the defendant could claim it's a trade secret, I'm not gonna give it to you. And that was it. Or if it's, for example, if it's a market in which sales are not well-tracked or easy to track, the plaintiff could ask for their sales volumes in order to figure out what the damages are, but the defendant could say, no, I'm not gonna give that to you. That's my trade secret, and it's highly confidential financial information, and I'm not gonna give it to you. And under the old rule, the answer was, okay, you don't have to, it's a trade secret, and the plaintiff, again, had trouble establishing the quantum of damages. So they finally changed that this year. So the change now is that if you're the defendant and you want to say, well, I don't want to produce this, it's trade secrets, you still have to prove it's trade secrets, but you now have to produce it And you can produce it either at, well, you can ask to produce it under a protect, what we would think of as a protective order, where it gets limited in terms of disclosure. And you can, of course, try to ask the court to exempt you from production because it's it's either such trade secrets that it should be protected or the material isn't really necessary for the plaintiff. In other words, the plaintiff can get this information in other ways. And then the law reaffirms that judges can make those negative inferences if you still refuse to produce at this point. Because if it's a change in law, it's hard to see whether the judges are gonna change their historical practice of not making those inferences, but at least the law as amended does, it doesn't require the judges to make that inference, but it gives some implication that they should be more willing to make those inferences against the defendant. So I think this especially is intended to help improve the enforcement process in Korea, because without this kind of change, it's very, very difficult for a plaintiff, except in some categories of cases where the product's easy to understand or the sales are easy to understand, to bring the case.
My understanding is in Japan, it's still the old system.
Yeah. So the other thing they did was they realigned the appellate path. So they said the graphics are really crappy. So the old structure is on the left side, and it used to be that district court opinions would be appealed to an intermediate appellate court called the High Court, and then that would go to the Supreme Court, right? And that was only on infringement and damages. And then the invalidity ruling would go up through KIPO through what's called the Patent Court, and then up to the Supreme Court. So the Korean Supreme Court was the only place, the Final Court of Appeals, where both issues were joined together. That's now been changed so that district court appeals go directly to the Patent Court, as well as the invalidity appeals from KIPO. Right? And so you have more of a kind of federal circuit-y type of appellate path. The other issue, it's not stated on the left side here, there's more than one high court in Korea, because there were 58-ish or so district courts. There's only 23 high courts, right? And so you had a lot of different appellate panels into intermediate between there and the Supreme Court. Okay. Standard essential patents. How many people have had to deal with FRAND issues and SEPs? Yeah. So. Hot topic, especially in telecom. Those of you who've litigated the issue know there's actually not a lot of case law. I mean, there's more coming out. There's not a ton of case law on SEPs and FRAND issues. And so certainly in the cases I've litigated, people tend to cite to antitrust guidelines from different governments because that's at least some authoritative pronouncement on FRAND and licensing issues in the standard essential context. So the Korean FTC clarified or reissued their IP guidelines earlier this year. One of the interesting things under prior Korean law, standard patents as defined under the prior law included de facto standards, not true standard essential patents, things that were kind of deemed to be de facto, kind of necessary to use. They got rid of that, right? So now SEPs according to the FTC, they consider SEPs to be true standard essential patents that are subject to a FRAND obligation. They've limited it to that. And I think that brings them in line with almost every other major jurisdiction in the world. The other issue that they've done in their IP guidelines this year is discuss the issue of refusals to license by a patent holder. And when is that truly anti-competitive, and when is it something that's actionable. In the guidelines, they've identified factors that go into their unfairness evaluation. They look at intent, or the purpose for refusing to license, how badly the potential licensee can or cannot participate in the relevant market, or if they unavoidably continue to be in an inferior competitive position in the relevant market. Whether the patentee has exclusive possession or control of the relevant technology, whether there really aren't any good substitutes for that technology, and this one is interesting, whether the refusal to license caused or may cause competition restraining effect, right? So you can see companies who are the subject, who want to take a license at their rate, but can't, can certainly probably use this to raise complaints with the Korean FTC. And I think these are both broad and vague enough standards that it gives potential complainants a lot of basis to go complain about patent owners who are demanding too much. And I think I've used up too much time. So we'll give it over to Alex now.
Yeah, we'll turn it over to Alex to talk about China. Well, while Alex is getting ready, maybe I'll just ask quickly.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier a little bit about whether you think patent trolls will, or patent assertion entities will grow in Korea. Alex may make some comments about China. I founded an organization called the License on Transfer Network, which is meant to reduce the patent assertion entity problem. The basic idea is any company can sign onto this open agreement that allows every company that signs onto it agrees that they'll license the other members to the extent those patents end up in the hands of a patent assertion entity. And it's grown from 6 members to about 100 members and covers about 600,000 patent assets at this point. It's based on a worldwide portfolio, right? So it covers all your assets. And the question is, you know, as I was forming this organization, I got a lot of questions from companies saying, can we just make it US? Because that's really where we see the patent assertion entity problem existing. Curious your thoughts about how this plays out in Korea. You were saying that you think things may be changing in Korea.
Yeah, so currently I don't think there really is a patent assertion entity problem in Korea. To the extent there are non-practicing, research organizations, for example, they tend to sell their patents to other entities that then monetize, probably here in the US. But in terms of pure litigation and enforcement in Korea by Korean entities, that hasn't been a big problem. People are worried about it there. Part of it is, and we talked about this, is the structure of the legal profession there. There's a very low bar passage rate in Korea, and historically, and so there's never been a well-developed plaintiff's bar.
You were saying there. It's 0.5%
yeah,
or something.
Yeah,
like that
historically it was just hundreds of people every year, and so now they've changed to a JD system like the U.S. and they've changed the bar passage rate. So it's now a few thousand people a year, but the problem is they're all young and they're all entering the market, and a lot of them are not finding jobs. So this is my supposition. We've seen this in the securities class action standpoint. There was never a securities bar in Korea. Now they're starting to develop one, and so they're starting to develop a plaintiff's bar in that area. So I think, given market forces, if you've got too many lawyers, somebody there is going to decide to become a plaintiff's lawyer and try to figure out a way to make a living doing that, and it'll go to patents.
And speaking of that, there's been a huge increase in patent filings in China. So yeah. tell us about the China.
Okay.
China
okay. So since today I'm a last presenter, so I promise you I will keep my talk short. So how many of you have visited China before? Oh, that's pretty much. Okay. So today, my topic will, cover very broadly about China patent law system development. So I do not cover very detailed information. So just very broad, some number, the patent filing, the patent litigation, and some new amendment, and some one or two cases is very interesting in China. So the first one is the patent filing in China. Just as Eric said, in China this year, they passed the 1 million patent application, the bar. So I think that set the bar over 5 to 10 years ago. So they have a national strategy that said, we want to be the number one patent filer in China because I think from the top of the government, they're trying to build up the country as an innovative country, not only manufacture in China, they want to be innovate in China. You can see here from the WIPO number, so this year they have over 1 million invention patent filed in China. Invention patent in China is actually exactly as the utility invention in the U.S. In China, also the around 3 million trademark filing in China. So you can see a lot of happen in China today. So this is the chart I think we get from WIPO's website. So you can see here the majority of the filing from China, the red color, the majority of filing actually from the local Chinese company, not a foreign company. I think a foreign company around 10 to 15%. So most of the company are from China. So the reason why there are so many filing, I think the first one, the government encourage also the economy. So local company, although they want to compete, use the technology. So the government trying to encourage also the trying to give some sponsor to get the funding, but the some of the new tech company like Huawei or some high tech, they compete with the local competitor. They also compete with the foreign competitor. So I think that's the one of the rule they want to use to compete, how to navigate that system. So, but here you can see here only 4% of this 1 million filing that file abroad. That means I think a couple of reasons. The first reason because in China, if you file, it's cheap compared with file internationally. The second one is how to commercialize the patent, because if you spend the money, but how you make money, that's the another problem. So that's the reason I see a lot of opportunity in China for the IP commercialization. Also, I see a lot of company over there, individual lawyer, that all we talk about, not only filing today, they talk about how to commercialize, how to make money from my filing. That's the big challenge. I think that's also will be have a lot happening in China in the next 5 to 10 years. So in China, they don't have a number of national the patent litigation number. So we do some research from the Beijing IP court. In Beijing, they created a special IP court only tried intellectual property related matters. So if you have patent, you have trademark, you have copyright, all IP related, you can just go to the same court. Before you have to go to a different court, different jurisdiction, but today it doesn't matter related to the civil litigation, administrative litigation, or criminal litigation. You just go to one court, they charge all theirs, anything IP related. You can you can see from the number, the total number here, there, they have a lot of administrative review case because, either SIPO, the State Intellectual Property Office, or Trademark Office, they make a lot of decisions. So if you are not happy about the decision, you can go to the IP court. So that's the reason the IP, Beijing IP court is very, very busy. So they also try a lot of IP civil case in China, in Beijing. I think in terms of the patent case, they only have around 20% or something, all IP related the civil case in Beijing. So also you can see here, we do some research, for the foreign patent related cases in IP court in Beijing, foreign case that have around 20%, but from U.S. perspective, this 20% that have, I think they have very heavy cases in Beijing from U.S. company, either U.S. company the defendant or plaintiff. So I think a lot of U.S. companies, they think Beijing IP court is one of the best venue that should consider about whenever you have a case tried in China. So in China, they have a fourth amendment of the patent law. They
Alex, could I interrupt for a second before
yes.
you leave the litigation? I've heard it said that it's really important to know, to have counsel that knows the regional court or the court that you're in China.
Yeah.
Could you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, I will cover a little bit. Yeah. So in China, they have a Fourth Amendment patent law amendment. So if you look at China patent history, they have the first patent law in 1985. That's very, very beginning. So I think that because China want to, you know, open the door, so I think they have a lot of pressure from either in China or from foreign country. I think especially from the US, you know, perspective, they want to open the market, but you have to protect my technology. So the first amendment, the first patent law, even the second patent law or third patent law, I think the major drive of the China patent law is from outside, because they want to go to China market, they have, want to compete there, you know, freely. But the Fourth Amendment, I think, not only from the foreign country, also a lot of Chinese company, they also have such need, because they see the competition, they don't want the product copied by the you know, the competitor. So so the Fourth Amendment, the patent law amendment, so it, right now it's still pending, but I think there will be in effect maybe next year. Erica just said, you know, how about the other IP card? So typically, before these three IP card was created in 2014, so they have three IP card in China, that's Beijing card, Shanghai card, and Guangzhou IP card. This very high developed area. Before these three card, IP card are created, they have around, I would say maybe 30 to 35 intermediate court in China that can try patent case. But since they have a lot of IP issues over there, they want to create some model in China to try the IP cases. So these three IP court was created almost 2 years ago. So they try a lot of cases, you know, especially, you know, in Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou, they tried a lot of cases there. So I think these three court also the best venue for, you know, foreign company, if you think about, you know, fairness, appearance or something. So this is the best venue for this select. So I will skip the card. So the first amendment, they have a lot of amendments. So the first one, I think, is a very good sign about the discovery. In China, we have no discovery system. So this amendment, they give some tools, I would say the limited discovery tools to for the plaintiff. So if you give some evidence to the court, and sometimes it's very hard to for the plaintiff to present the evidence, you can ask the judge to get some discovery or some evidence. If the defendant refuses to, you know, provide any proof, so any evidence you present to the court or to the judge, the judge can adopt it. I think that's one of the two, you know, the Fourth Amendment. So it's very, very, it's a great sign for the China patent law. So the second one, I would say it's called IP ownership or the work made for hire. Before when you work for a company, like employee, if you do not sign anything, so your work automatically belong to the employer. But right now, so based on the new proposal, if you do not have any agreement, so the invention will be belong to the employee. So they encourage the innovation, they encourage the work, do the work, you know. So for every employer in China, especially for the foreign company, so I think the agreement or the labor agreement, I think that's very important in place if you want to, you know, make some innovation there. I know I only have 4 minutes. So in China, they also introduced the first time the punitive damage. Before that, you know, a lot of infringement, but the damage is very, very low. So Right now, they introduce the same concept as here. So if you are, infringing intentionally, they can give you up to two or three times the remedy you can collect. So amendment is that they give a lot of power to the administrative authority. So you can see from this slide, if someone to infringe your case, you can go to the administrative authority to ask them confiscate or destroy the patented products, as well as the components, the tools, anything, so if they think it's infringed. So also the extended the patent administrative authority to one step down to all county level. Before they only have a city level or prince level, they have a administrative authority, but right now they want to expand the authority to all the county level. So I think that's another major change for the Fourth Amendment. So I think the takeaway here for the new patent law, I think they provide limited discovery tools. They also encourage the invention. It's better good for the employee. Also, they introduce the punitive damages, trying to curb the infringement. But the last one, they may be overused or abused administrative power. I think that's a major concern for everybody in China, especially for foreign company in China. How many seconds I have? How many minutes I have? 2 minutes, okay. So these three cases are very interesting. The first one is actually is the design patent litigation in China. They have a decision by the Beijing administrative authority. It's not a decision by court. So everything still can appeal, is pending. So one of the Chinese company that make a cell phone here at the right side, it's not a big company, so I never hear this company. They file a design patent. So after Apple released the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, they just go to Beijing IP authority, the local office, they bring a case against Apple. So after, they did some investigation, so the authority said, you infringe the design. So after the decision, Apple appealed the administrative order to Beijing IP court. So the appeal is still pending. But if the appeal decided by the court, so that may be probably your iPhone 6 Plus cannot sell in China. So this is the sign to tell how powerful administrative authority can decide, especially for the design patent, for some utility model patent in China. It's very easy, it's very quick. So I think that's one of the tools for a lot of foreign company that should think about whenever they're trying to protect the IP in China.
And what's the total timeline for the appeal?
What's that?
The total timeline for the appeal.
I think that the appeal over, typically they will decide it within a year, but for the there is a foreign party related, typically they have no time limit, but it takes about 1.5 years, but it all depends on what kind of element.
Yeah, I think we should cut it.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you all very much. Yeah. Really appreciate it.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, it's a little bit like the U.S. Marines, the few, the proud, the brave. You get the prize for staying. Thank you all very much. Please thank our BCLT staff who put a huge amount of effort into this. Richard Fisk in the back, and Louise Lee, who's I think outside, but thank Richard. Obviously, we want to thank our sponsors. We added a couple of new sponsors this year, Intel, FinGen, and Bloomberg Law, in addition to our perennial and much-valued sponsors at Inflection Point and Hickman Palermo and Lidonomics. We are set for next year, December 14th and 15th. We're going to be moving to the Computer History Museum next year, but obviously we will be in touch with all of you well in advance of that. So it's going to be 1 week later next year. So with that, please thank again our last panel for being gracious enough and brave enough and good enough to be the last panel. And thank you all, and have a great weekend.